Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, we talk with Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody, ahead of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. But first, Governor Rick Snyder has appointed Heidi Grether as the new head of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. You might remember Snyder accepted the resignation of the previous director, Dan Wyatt, back in December. That was after a task force investigating the Flint water crisis held the Department of Environmental Quality largely responsible. Joining us via Skype to talk about the appointment of Heidi Grether is Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Grether is the current deputy director for the Michigan Agency for Energy. She's worked as a legislative aide in Michigan and as an oil and gas industry lobbyist. She was an executive at BP America, where she helped manage Gulf Coast restoration efforts after the Deepwater Horizon disaster back in 2010. The Detroit News reported she managed public relations for BP in that effort. So, Ken, first we should note that you were on that task force that I mentioned earlier. And having said that, did the governor just hire a PR expert to head up the Department of Environmental Quality or an experienced corporate executive?
Well, I would sort of add a third option, which is I think what he did. I think he hired somebody with a lot of environmental experience and a lot of knowledge about the Michigan situation, which I think is frankly quite good. And although some environmental groups are criticizing her for her BP background, I think it actually might help given the situation with the DEQ and questions of confidence and trust. And that'll be her biggest challenge. And I worked with, in terms of transparency, I actually worked with Heidi 20 years ago when she worked in the Michigan legislature, and I was a state house member, and she has a lot of environmental background. I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised, frankly.
Well, as you mentioned, the Sierra Club, the League of Conservation Voters, they're not happy with this appointment of Grether. They don't like her ties to the gas and oil industry. In light of the Flint water crisis, the Enbridge oil spill in the Kalamazoo River, and the concerns about aging oil pipelines in the Great Lakes, I'm wondering how this appointment will appear, Susan.
Well, the DEQ is going to oversee the process for this pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac. It's Enbridge Line 5. And as you know, we had our own environmental disaster in 2010 when there was a pipeline burst in Kalamazoo. When Grether was working for BP America, there was, of course, the most notorious oil spill ever. It was the Deepwater Horizon disaster, and 11 people were killed, and it actually resulted, I believe, in the largest corporate fine in American history. So definitely Snyder has given his enemies some material to work with. I think the optics are unfortunate. And I do think that there is some concern about the fox guarding the hen house.
The Michigan Chamber of Commerce says this is a sound choice from the private sector. But I have to tell you, Ken, I think this appears a little tone deaf. How much discussion about appearances do you think was going on in the governor's office about this appointment?
Well, I think appearances are important. Don't get me wrong. But I do think she brings sort of the right skill set. She's got that Michigan background that I mentioned. But really, I think that the challenge is going to be for her or anybody else, frankly. I don't really care what their background is. The challenge is going to be the ability to inspire confidence and trust in the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. Their mission is to protect the environment. To the extent she insists on that and demonstrates that over time, I think she will do well. But that, frankly, is going to be her challenge or anybody's challenge, no matter what their background going forward.
I want to ask you both, does it typically take more than 6 months to find a director for a major state agency? Dan Wyatt left in December.
Well, that is a long time, but considering the fact that the DEQ was such a high-profile department and the last director, Dan Wyatt, had to resign due to the issues over the Flint water crisis, I think Governor Snyder really wanted to take his time and find the person who he was most comfortable with to lead this very important department.
Yeah, no, 6 months is long. I mean, let's look at it. When a governor gets elected in November, they tend to make all their appointments sort of by January. So they take 2 months, not six. But hey, this is a different situation, given DEQ, given Flint. The eyes of the the state, and people of the state are on this agency, and there are a lot of questions. So it's a very sensitive appointment, no question about it.
Ken, you were the majority leader of the Senate. The Senate has to confirm Grether as director. Will this be a rubber stamp, or will she be questioned hard?
Well, she's going to get questioned hard. I mean, if the Republicans don't, the Democrats certainly will. It would be highly unusual, frankly, for Republican majority in the Senate to reject one of the governor's appointments here. That's not going to happen. But there's going to be some tough questions, and she's going to be on the spot. She's got to be well prepared for that public hearing. She has to do well.
Susan, bottom line it for us, can Heidi Grether restore the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality's reputation, as Ken suggests is the task of anybody taking that position?
I think that's a very tall task. You still have many issues going on in Flint. Very few of the lead lines have been replaced. Federal money has been tied up. And you have tests for some younger residents of Flint showing high lead levels even today. And so, you know, to ask one person to restore the reputation of the department, that is a lot to ask. And probably this is going to be an ongoing issue for the next DEQ director under the next governor.
That's Susan Demas. She is publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. We also heard from Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Thanks for talking with us about this.
Hey, thanks, Lester.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For our second report in our new series, Artisans of Michigan, we go to Brighton and the Thompson Art Glass Studio. The Thompson family has been constructing stained glass and leaded glass windows in Michigan since 1929.
You know, we're not interested in making sun catchers or little things that we sell at craft fairs. That's just not our business. Our business is stuff that's much longer lasting than that.
Dirk Thompson says he's talking about churches, colleges, businesses, and high-end homes. Thompson Art Glass also does a lot of restoration work. The day I visited, his son, Dirk Thompson Jr., was piecing together a leaded glass window for Cranbrook Academy of Art. Seems a stray soccer ball crashed into the window. He held a piece of glass in his hand, and he began to scribe an arc freehanded.
Now that's some skill. Actually, Lester, I'm a bit off.
He teaches his students how to do that in class one.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's what most people are afraid of, is the technique of cutting glass.
The Thompsons work all over Michigan, parts of Ohio, Canada. Work is steady, but over the last couple of decades, a major source of business has slowed.
Demand for church windows, there hasn't been as many church windows built in the last 20 years, so the demand is down.
So not a lot of new churches, but there are some additions to churches, and the stained glass windows are still in demand there. Thompson says there's been growth in other areas, homes. And in Michigan, a lot of those stained glass scenes are not necessarily biblical. They're often hunting scenes.
We get a lot of wildlife requests. We get a lot of requests for flowers and for foliage scenes, grapes and leaves, and again, more wildlife.
Just looking at these sketches of completed jobs, you've got moose, otter, deer, hunting dogs, wolf, cardinals. It's pretty extensive.
Aquarium, yep. They bring us in their ideas. If they have any photos, they bring those along. And then we do composite drawings and develop the concept.
It's no accident that Dirk Thompson entered the family business. It was encouraged. It was planned.
When I was a kid, our grandfather sent the four grandsons that seemed to be inclined in grade school. He sent us all to art class every summer. And in high school, he sent us to art class at Cranbrook Academy. To be honest with you, I worked here at the shop on Saturdays with my dad since about seventh grade. I had no question what I was going to do because I just absolutely loved the artwork.
Dirk Thompson Jr. is the fourth generation of the family in Thompson Art Glass. Dirk Sr. says he's glad the family business is still going strong.
I'm just thrilled as can be. I've got currently got three young grandsons, and I hope they're going to be the fifth generation. But, again, that has yet to be seen.
Both the Thompsons say they can't imagine doing anything else. Seeing a concept build to reality is rewarding in itself. But the senior Thompson says a particularly large job, three walls of stained glass at St. Mary's in Pinckney, led the bishop to pull Dirk Thompson aside.
He told me personally, he said, you know, this was a beautiful building, but now that it's got the stained glass in it, it's a place of God. And, I mean, that statement really blew me away. I mean, that's worth any amount of money in the world to get a compliment like that.
That's Dirk Thompson of Thompson Art Glass in Brighton, the latest installment in our series, Artisans of Michigan. Still to come, as print journalism declines, editorial cartoonists have taken it on the chin. But could the social media reality of clicks and shares revive the centuries-old profession? In 15 minutes, we talk with Michigan Radio's editorial cartoonist, John Ochter. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Republican National Convention opens Monday in Cleveland. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody is already in Cleveland now to find out what's going on. There's been a lot going on just this past week with the Rules Committee and everything. You covered the Republican Convention 4 years ago. How do you expect this year's convention to be different?
Well, the big difference for me, well, there's a very low likelihood of a hurricane interrupting the convention like it did 4 years ago.
I forgot about that.
That actually canceled the first day of the convention. Not a lot of wind here in Cleveland. In fact, it's a beautiful day right now. And it's going to be different, I think, mainly because 4 years ago, the insiders were in control of the convention with Mitt Romney. This year, definitely, it's more of an outsider's convention with Donald Trump.
The city of Cleveland has increased its protest insurance by a factor of five. There are reports that chaos is expected. Do you expect to be spending most of your time inside the convention center or outside in the streets?
Well, I think I'm going to split my time pretty evenly between the two. I think there's going to be a lot going on inside the convention. And I don't know if there's going to be chaos outside. I think it's going to be, there's definitely going to be a presence on the part of people who are in support of Donald Trump, and also a sizable presence that I'm starting to see already of people opposed to Donald Trump. We'll see, you know, if there is going to be any kind of violence or any kind of confrontations. At this point, I'm surprised there's not more of downtown that's been blocked off. It's actually pretty open. It was easy to get around downtown today. I think that will definitely begin to change tomorrow, and this city will probably be just guessing at all of the barriers that are, you know, set up to be put up. I think the city will be pretty much locked down by Sunday.
The Rules Committee has been meeting this week. Some Republicans are still trying to block a Donald Trump nomination. Have you been able to talk to anybody who might be on the inside and knows a little bit about that?
Yes, I spoke with Matt Hall. He is a delegate from Grand Rapids, who is one of two Michigan delegates who were on the Rules Committee. Now, they wrapped up their work last night, Thursday night, and Matt explained to me that basically what they did, they, you know, have as far as he's concerned, they have ended the Dump Trump movement.
Because they only had 13 votes in committee, that means they don't have the 25%. They would need 28 votes. And therefore, there's no way procedurally they could bring this forward to the convention, and therefore this is dead. The Never Trump movement is dead, and the party can now move forward united behind Donald Trump and Mike Pence as our vice president.
Now, because you're a glutton for trouble or just love politics that much, you're also going to be covering the Democrats in Philadelphia. I was looking at the speaker rundown for both conventions. A lot of prominent Democrats speaking at that party's convention. A lot of prominent Republicans not even attending the GOP convention. What's that say about the parties and the presumptive nominees?
Well, I think in many ways this is a situation of between non-insiders and insiders. The insiders, the party regulars, are going to be in charge in Philadelphia. In Cleveland, it's going to be the non-insiders. I don't want to say so much of the outsiders, because when you look at a lot of the people who are going to be speaking, these are not like people on the outside. These are influential people, just not necessarily normally influential people in the Republican Party. So I think what you have here is you have, you know, the insurgents taking over the Republican convention. I'm sure the party regulars who are not part of the convention now will get more on board as we get past Labor Day and it becomes a race of winning in November. And at this point, the Democrats are largely already all on board, all the insiders. It's just getting all those Bernie Sanders supporters to hook on as well. And those are the two issues that the parties are facing after the conventions.
Now, there are lots and lots of stories to be found at a convention like this. You take your pick. I'm just wondering, what's on your mind? What are you thinking about looking into first?
Well, the thing I'm most interested in today is just getting a feel of how the city is going to be transitioning from where it is right now, which is just a beautiful summer Friday afternoon, to having, as I said, that whole lockdown take effect. We've seen what happened in Nice, France this week. There have been other incidents, obviously, involving terrorism. And I think that's going to be a major issue here in town, and it's also a major issue at the convention, because security is one of the issues that they want to push during this convention.
That's Steve Carmody in Cleveland. He's a Michigan radio reporter. Hey, work hard, but have some fun if you can.
I'll work hard.
All right, thanks, Steve. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. All right, lean back. Let's have a little wordplay with University of Michigan English professor Ann Curzon. There are all kinds of terms that make you wonder, where did that come from? Rigmarole, Bob's your uncle, cattywampus. So we ask listeners, what's the weirdest word or phrase that you've used and wondered where that come from? And listeners answered. Here's what we're going to see today. Let's start with cattywampus from Cindy. What does cattywampus mean?
Do you use the word cattywampus?
I do. I'm from Southern Illinois, though, so that's a word we use.
And what do you use it to mean?
It went out of control, or it's across the way, either way. So they use kitty corner and catty corner and cattywampus all the same, but usually it means just went out of control.
Okay. Can it ever mean askew for you? Like it's sort
askew
of cattywampus?
Would be out of
order. Okay.
Yeah.
And if it's across the way, you used catter corner or kitty corner.
Kitty corner,
so it's
catty
across
corner.
The way, but diagonal, right?
Right. Yes.
Cattywampus, and I would guess that not everyone knows this word, spelled in different ways, catty, catta, wampus. You'll find it in the Midwest. You'll find it in the Northeast. The Dictionary of American Regional English has it and says it can either mean awry or askew, or it can mean diagonally across from. For many of us, and I have to say, I'm not a cattywampus speaker, although I wish I were, because one of the quotes I found is, everything's gone cattywampus on me this week. And I thought, I want to use that.
That sounds like folks back at my hometown.
But I learned a little bit about catty corner, which I thought, well, where does that come from?
Right.
It comes from catter corner. And catter goes back to Old French for four, quatre. It's four corner, and it referred to the dice with four. And you can see then how you get into the diagonal. So it became a verb and an adverb meaning diagonal. And then you had catter cornered, which was on the diagonal. And then people didn't know where it came from, and they thought, oh, it must be about cats. And so we got kitty corner.
Ah, okay. Well, another one was sent in. Yvonne Niaz sent in recombobulate.
One of my favorite words. I want to use cattywampus, and I use recombobulate. Not everybody does, but I hope we can make it catch on. It goes back to discombobulate, which is one of my favorite words. And nobody knows where discombobulate comes from, which, again, the mysteries of English. It shows up in – the OED has it in 1825, and it first shows up as discombobulate. Okay. And over time, it becomes discombobulate. Maybe it's from discompose, discomfort, and people were just playing around with it. Once you have discombobulate, you can backform combobulate. Nobody uses that. But once you have combobulate, then you can recombobulate.
Of course you should.
Yes. Reorganize yourself. And I have to recombobulate several times a day. Now, here's an interesting fact. In 2008, the American Dialect Society, and I'm a member of that, we vote on the word of the year. And in 2008, the most creative word of the year was recombobulation area, which is in the Milwaukee airport. After you go through security, there is the recombobulation area.
Really?
Where you can, you know, put your belt back on and put your stuff
back
in your bag.
I've been to that airport. I don't remember being recombobulated.
There's only one concourse where you can recombobulate.
Okay. We've got one phrase here, soup to nuts.
I had never thought about this.
Oh, and I should say this is on Twitter from at PM Hoffman.
It's a U.S. expression. It goes back to the middle of the 19th century, and it's about meals. You start with a soup, and for people for whom dessert is fruit and nuts, the whole meal is soup to nuts.
Well, that's an easy enough one. All right, so this one's from Jim Koons, the whole nine yards. Where does that come from?
This one's complicated.
Oh, yeah?
There are a lot of stories.
You had me at recombobulate. I don't know.
There are a lot of stories out there about the whole nine yards, that it comes from the ammunition belts for machine guns in aircraft in World War II, that it's the amount of concrete that you can get into a concrete mixer, that it's the length of fabric in Scottish quilt or in a sari. Or there are lots of stories, including that it has something to do with football. But of course, that would be 10 yards, not 9 yards. This has, again, been one of those mysteries in English. Bonnie Taylor Blake did some great work on this, found it first back into the 1950s, then found it in 1921 as the whole 6 yards of it, which was the whole story. And Fred Shapiro, who edits the Yale Book of Quotations, has found it back to 1912 in Kentucky, again, as the whole 6 yards. So some linguists are saying the number may not be relevant, that 6 just turned into 9 the way that Cloud 7 turned into Cloud 9, that this can happen. But the OED just updated their entry, and they now have it back to 1855 with this story in an Indiana newspaper from 1855 called The Judge's Big Shirt. And it's this story where he says he gave his wife enough to make 3 shirts, but instead of making 3, she's put the whole 9 yards into 1 shirt. And that story got retold. But many linguists are saying, the gap's too big. I don't think the story's where it came from. But the mystery continues.
Well, somebody should find that. And I think it's your task now, so you have to take it on. That is University of Michigan English professor Ann Curzan. You can also hear her on That's What They Say on Michigan Radio on Sunday mornings. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. At one time, there were a lot of political cartoonists out there, and I can't count the times I've seen a political cartoon get to the heart of an issue more quickly, more sharply, than some of even the better op-ed columns. But it seems there are not as many political cartoonists anymore. One of them has made the move from newspaper online to radio, Michigan radio, as a matter of fact. John Ochter joins me now. First, how'd you end up as a political cartoonist for a radio station?
Well, it's just kind of the nature of how the editorial cartoonist business is going. The traditional venue is newspapers, and since the decline of newspapers, particularly the larger ones who were able to support either a staff cartoonist or, in my case, freelance contributors, and it's all part of looking to, at least for me, looking to other areas where I thought there was a good fit. And with Michigan radio, particularly the past couple of years, the investigative reporting and the traditional journalism they've been doing has really picked up what was left in the void of the larger newspapers, just abdicating their positions.
Now, your cartoons are coming out on Friday on Michigan Radio. For somebody who hasn't seen your cartoons, how do you describe them? What's the style?
My style, I guess, would be. which is not so traditionally what you would think of as an editorial cartoon. And that's been part of why, I guess, early on, why I was never able to, I was never broke in, I was never a staff cartoonist when I was younger and more newspapers around and I was taking my cartoons. I would invariably, from editors, they would look at it and read them and thought, well, they're funny, they're insightful, but they just don't look like an editorial cartoon. The traditional was black and white, a lot of cross-hatching, a lot of labels.
Often single panel, yeah.
Yeah, so I was never that tradition, but I've done some like that. I tend to bounce around in whatever fits the idea, so I might have a single panel or I might have four panels. It just depends on what suits the idea the best.
So where have you been working? How long have you been working doing editorial cartoons?
Pretty much forever, but cartooning in general, but really in earnest for editorial cartoons, my college newspaper at Michigan Tech and some other newspapers, but it really didn't start being a regular thing until, I think it was 1995, when I started drawing for the Grand Rapids Business Journal. Really, from that point on, I've done at least a cartoon a week, usually Michigan-based.
I'm just wondering why we're seeing so few editorial cartoonists today when we used to have so many. In fact, I don't know what the decline is, but it seems to be significant.
It is. Even 20 years ago, 10 years ago, there were, I would think, over 100 staff cartoonists at newspapers. Now there's probably maybe between 30 and 40.
I don't understand that. I understand the decline of newspapers, but it seems like editorial cartoons would be a perfect fit for the internet. I mean, it just seems like with all the memes out there, maybe some intelligent commentary from a political cartoonist or editorial cartoonist would be perfect for the internet. I guess you just can't monetize it, right?
This is exactly the conversations that editorial cartoonists have when they get together. Why aren't we more popular? Yeah, it just seems, you know, in an age where people want to see quick and fast and condensed, you know, it really is a perfect vehicle. I think part of it comes from it was never really a comfortable fit, even in the halcyon days with newspapers. Newspapers, by and large, were run by people who are word people, particularly on the editorial pages, and they were never really comfortable or understood and, frankly, jealous of the popularity of the editorial cartoon. After they had spent a whole day hammering out a well-thought editorial and people were largely mostly attracted to the drawing that was on the page, that never went down well. That was never comfortable, and so it was always hard to find advocates at newspapers. And when things started to decline, they really had no trouble in letting go of the editorial cartoonists first. It really comes down to, like you hinted at, their monetizing. That was the comfortable position. That was to be a staff cartoonist was a decent living. You didn't get rich, but it was, you know, a good middle income sort of job to have. And then once that went away, not just the bigger newspapers, but alternative cartoonists that would contribute to weekly alternatives, they started going away too. So there's been a bit of a scramble. Okay, well, what's the next thing?
You've been writing essays to accompany the Friday Octor Art cartoons. Is that new for you? What do you think of that?
You know, it started from friends and family who didn't live in Michigan or really weren't up on the sometimes esoteric things that I was drawing about would say, I want to see a cartoon, send it to me. And I would go, but
you're not going to get it.
Yeah. So I started an email list. It started with that, and I would write just a short background on it. Then I had a website, and then it grew into a blog. And then when I was trying to work things out with MLive to continue on drawing for them, I said, you know, this could be a bonus. If online is really where you're taking things, well, then I could have the cartoon there along with this short essay. So it's really just a continuation of doing that. It's just evolved.
John Octor is an editorial cartoonist who's currently drawing for Michigan Radio. Octor's art is posted at michiganradio.org on Fridays. John, nice to meet you. Nice to talk to you.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
Up next, sentencing children to life in prison without parole.
Judges are trying to appease the public, so the public wants these quote-unquote dangerous people to be locked up for life.
Then taking on racial inequality, Detroit's urban consulate creates a space for conversation. That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside for Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The release of a young man who had been sentenced to life without parole has been in the news a lot recently. Devontae Sanford was convicted and sentenced at age 14 for four murders. The courts recently found he was wrongfully convicted. In 2012, the Supreme Court banned the use of mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles, but that doesn't mean it's completely banned. Joining us via Skype to talk about that is Lisa Armstrong. She wrote an article for The Intercept entitled Hard Time. Under what circumstances is sentencing a juvenile to life without parole still possible?
Basically, judges are supposed to look at mitigating factors. So the age of the child, the crime that was committed, that child's background and other things. And then judges, based on that, are allowed to sentence someone to life without parole. If for whatever reason they determine that those factors mean that the person needs to be in for life, then they will sentence them to life. So it's up to a judge.
What do you mean by child's background?
The environment in which a child grows up, whether that person has two parents in the home, whether that person lives in a neighborhood where there's a lot of gun violence or there's violence in the home itself, basically how the person has been raised.
You wrote, in some states, judges are still giving juvenile life without parole sentences on a fairly frequent basis, and that Michigan has the highest per capita rate of these sentences. What's happening in Michigan that more juveniles are still being sentenced to life without parole?
Well, it seems to be a couple of things, and this came mainly from speaking with judges themselves. It seems that the laws in Michigan, where someone who is 17 is automatically tried as an adult, and then also the fact that people who are accessories to a crime can also be charged in the same way that someone who actually pulled the trigger can be, that that's a factor. But it's also that judges are used to giving certain sentences. So they're used to giving life without parole for certain crimes, and they kind of have just continued doing that. So it's a pattern of behavior. And then I also heard from some people that in high-profile cases, such as the one that I featured in my story, judges are trying to appease the public. So the public wants these quote-unquote dangerous people to be locked up for life. So that's what's being done.
Right. The person you profiled as an example was a Detroit man named Robert Taylor. How old was he when he was sentenced to life in prison?
He was 16 when the crime was committed. I believe when he was actually sentenced, he was 17 or almost 18 years old.
What justification did the prosecution use to pursue that sentence?
The prosecution argued that he had been present. This was a case of murder. He and Ihab Masamani, who was his co-defendant, had carjacked someone and this young man, Matthew Landry, and he was killed. And the prosecution argued that Robert Taylor had been there and that even though he hadn't pulled the trigger, that, you know, he didn't do anything to stop it. So he was essentially culpable in the crime because he was there when it was committed.
How did the defense respond to that argument? How do they argue for a lesser sentence?
The defense for Robert, his lawyer said that he was not there when the crime was committed. And this is something that Robert himself told me and that Ihab confirmed. But they said that, yes, he had gotten in the car, but that he did not know what was going to happen. He wasn't in on this plan to commit the murder and that he wasn't there. So he therefore shouldn't have been sentenced to life.
So what are the people you've talked to, the judges, the lawyers, and so forth, do they think that this sentence, life without parole for a 16-year-old who may or may not have been at the scene of the crime at the time, do they feel that it's justified? Or how do they justify it?
Obviously, I mean, there are advocates who feel that it's not fair, that no child should really be sentenced to life without parole because, you know, they're not really able to make decisions as adults. And then there are prosecutors who feel, I mean, the prosecutor in this case did not speak with me, but I think the feeling is that these people are dangerous and that they should be off the streets. I did speak with people whose loved ones have been victims of crimes perpetrated by juveniles who feel that, you know, they should be locked up, that each time if there is a parole hearing or if someone's going to be resentenced, that these loved ones have to relive the crime and it's not really fair to them. If you commit the crime, then you should do the time, essentially, is what they're saying.
And by that, they mean for life, not everything.
For life, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's this notion that you killed someone, you took someone's life, so therefore your life should be gone as well.
Earlier this year, the Supreme Court decided the 2012 ruling banning life for juveniles was retroactive. But there are still many, in fact, thousands of juveniles serving those sentences across the nation. What's the reason for that?
Like, why are they still in? I mean, I think in each state, obviously, there's going to be a process to determine how those cases are going to be handled. So I think in some cases it would be years. If these people are going to be released, it would be years before they actually get out. I mean, aside from the reporting that I did on this story, I've also been talking with people, again, a lot of them in Michigan who've been in for decades. And it's not like anyone has contacted them and said, well, let's take a look at your case. They're aware of the ruling, but, you know, I think the process is going to be fairly slow before these people, if they are released at all, actually get out of prison.
So what do you want the readers of your article to take away? I mean, what's the main point you think they should understand?
That the Supreme Court ruled and said that these factors, like if in all of the cases that I've looked at, people have pretty much the same kind of life story where single parent, they grew up in pretty violent environment, they didn't have the best educations, there was often drug use or violence in the home. And so these are children who have not had the best opportunities. And so I think, you know, what advocates are saying is that that should be taken into consideration and that those people should be rehabilitated and then at some point released so that they can be productive members of society. But the judges that I profiled in the story have taken those very things, so those challenges that people have faced, and said, well, you face these challenges and therefore you should be locked up for life. And so that's the question that I want people to ask themselves. Is this fair? Is it right? Does it make sense? Is it the best use of taxpayer money? You know, because obviously money could be spent educating people versus keeping them in prison.
That's Lisa Armstrong. She wrote the article Hard Time for The Intercept. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
The Urban Consulate, according to its website, is a network of parlors for city dwellers and travelers seeking urban exchange. It's hosted conversations about economic development, cooperation, and recently conversations about race. Claire Nelson is Consul General of the Urban Consulate. It's active in Detroit, Philadelphia, and New Orleans. As part of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I recently talked with her at the headquarters in Detroit and asked her what the group means by parlors.
Well, it's not so much about the space, but the idea of people coming together to have frank conversations. We like conversations in an intimate setting. So in all three cities, we've done things in historic buildings, in neighborhoods that are changing. And the idea is to bring together different perspectives, hopefully.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about the goal behind it. Why do you want to have those conversations?
Well, initially, the idea came out of the growing awareness that for everyone who is doing amazing work in Detroit to improve their neighborhoods, there were twins that they had in other cities. So Detroit wasn't so alone in all of its challenges, and perhaps we could learn from other places. And there seemed to be a growing appetite at the time for more of those cross-city connections. But I will say that the consulate has also been playing, I think, an important role in just having intra-city conversations. So sometimes it's not about talking to someone, you know, across another place, but it's about talking about with someone across neighborhoods within the same community that don't always intersect or share ideas or thoughts on things.
And that's basically what I want to concentrate on. I mean, racial tensions are growing as the perceptions and evidence of racial inequality are growing. Many of Detroit's residents see billionaires buying up downtown. Mm-hmm. New retailers are opening, but they're selling things that most of Detroit's residents can't afford to buy. Mm-hmm. So there's this marked divide between that prosperity in the business districts and the poverty in the neighborhoods. So how is the Urban Consulate addressing those larger issues?
Yeah, those are big issues. I wouldn't pretend to say that we're going to solve any of those issues, but I think our approach is that sometimes these conversations are had, let's say, in social media or in the media and comment sections and other places. We like to bring people face-to-face to talk. I think we curate a number of different situations where people can have real and open dialogue about some of the challenges of growth and development. I think sometimes folks who really love the city, who have been boosters for a long time and want to promote, you know, good development and good change, get stuck in a situation where it's hard to be critical if you're promoting a place that you love. But we want to leave a little room for that. Sometimes, you know, being a good patriot is having some fair criticism for the place that you love. So we encourage that. And sometimes bringing people in from other cities who are facing the same challenges have some really interesting insights. So that, you know, Detroit isn't so exceptional. And in New Orleans, Philadelphia, they're having the same conversations that we have in cafes and bars and, you know, community centers like throughout the city. A big thought with a consulate is not feeling so isolated and alone. And also just listening, learning to listen to other people's stories and their experiences and their feelings as the city changes, because a lot of development investment is driven, you know, by dollars and numbers. And there's not always so much space in that change to stop and reflect on, yeah, but how does it feel to have your neighborhood change? And what are ways we can engage residents and citizens in deciding what that change looks like?
So a little bit of history.
Yeah.
After the uprisings across the nation in 1967, President Lyndon Johnson established a commission to find out what happened. The commission's report included the findings that white attitudes and white racism caused the tensions that led to the uprisings. The current political climate is causing a lot of black residents of Detroit and other cities to wonder if anything's really changed. What does Urban Consulate and its participants do to address those kinds of concerns?
Well, I think through our programming, some of our conversations, we've been intentional about making sure the right people are leading the conversation. So oftentimes when you're talking about development investment, the people speaking about that are the people who are representing, you know, the banks or commercial interests.
I'm guessing that's a lot of white faces.
Yes. And so we're trying to flip that a little bit and have the voices leading conversations be people who are more community-based, who are or creative artists or who've been around a little longer, can share some history and context. That's one way.
Too often we hear from white people in general a sentence that begins, I'm not a racist, but that brings us to the topic of unconscious bias or implicit bias. White people don't think of themselves as being biased or racist, and often they're quick to accuse black people as playing the race card. What do you make of that miscommunication or misunderstanding between people, and have you seen that in the parlors that you've held at the Urban Consulate?
That's a lot in there. I would say that at the parlors of the Urban Consulate, I think we were drawing mostly a pretty progressive audience that's interested in learning and open to changing their minds about things, open to new perspectives. I'd like to do better at that, to be honest, at getting more people in the room who might not or might think that they know everything already but have still some stuff to learn. I would argue that a lot of white folks, it's not that they don't think they're racist. Well, it's that they might say they're not racist. It's that they don't think about this very much at all to begin with. If it's not part of their work or part of their immediate circle of family relationships, it's probably not on their radar as much as we might think it is, especially right now with so much like national news and conversation happening around these topics too. You'd think that more people be plugged in, but personally, my experience is that some of my closest friends, who I think are progressive, don't necessarily spend a lot of time thinking about these issues.
I want to talk. You're white. Many of your colleagues are black. What kind of discussions do you guys have in private about racial tensions in the city?
Well, I would say that I feel very fortunate that I have friends who can be very honest and direct with me about ways that I might be blind to how I have contributed to some of the challenges that you're talking about, and have helped me kind of do some critical review of my own role in the city's change.
Can you give me an example? Is it like somebody you invited or didn't invite to one of the discussions here?
Yeah, I mean, well, I've had colleagues that I've worked with, I guess, for years and friends who I played different roles in the city. I was a small business owner. I worked in media before doing this project. And I think it's been a growing awareness and an ongoing conversation that's helped me see things that I didn't see 5 years ago. Examples, I guess, would be sources for stories or speakers that we've had who, for whatever reason, have a lot of courage in order to call out some stuff, some BS and some hypocrisy that I think I've been immune to perhaps before this. I think when you put yourself out there as someone who's interested in storytelling and conversations, maybe then that's a signal that you're open to learning and listening a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, I've been part of a media that was very promotional of Detroit, that was very pro-growth, that was very pro-investment, and sometimes not understanding the negative consequence of that. So, you know, I was the publisher of Model D, and I've hosted speaker series and events throughout the city for years. I help promote, do like promotions in Midtown for the local independent shops, and I've encouraged other friends of mine to open small businesses in the city. And I was doing all of that from a place that started with my personal problem that I was working towards being the regional segregation, right? So I was coming from a place where I was always encouraging folks to live closer together because I was bothered by the metropolitan segregation. But now as more people are moving back downtown, whether they're, you know, their parents left to go to the suburbs and they're returning or they're coming from other cities, I feel like that the tensions of segregation are just like a little bit more dense. There's still segregation still happening at a neighborhood level, whereas before it was at kind of a larger metropolitan area. And that means you're confronting it all the time. It's right in your face. So I could go with a black friend the other night to have dinner, and he's like, oh, my God, it's so white. And he saying it makes me more aware of something that maybe I would have noticed, but maybe I wouldn't have noticed so much. And I think, you know, it's a lot of it. For me, I feel like I've learned a lot from having people who having trusting relationships with friends and colleagues where we could have these private conversations. So I do have a lot of faith in the possibility that when people come together to share perspectives, it can change how people think. And I've seen people benefit from that and change over the years in their work, especially folks who work in economic development, who have a very, you know, numbers, profit-oriented mindset. I can see them change over time as they have maybe trusted confidants or colleagues who make them aware of the limitations of their thinking. But I also see a lot of people who maybe aren't so open-minded to seeing things in a different way, and that's where the challenge becomes, you know, is it a task of diplomacy or is it a task of activism? And that's a conversation we actually had here last week that I'm really interested in continuing.
Claire Nelson leads the Urban Consulate, which works in Detroit, Philadelphia, and New Orleans. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.